big trouble and tricky business. Seth Weinstein knew Tina was way out of his league in pretty much any way you could imagine, which was why it continued to astonish him that he was on a plane now for their destination wedding in Florida. The groom posse had already sprung an airport prank on him, and he'd survived it. And if that was the worst of it, everything should be okay. Smooth sailing from now on. Seth has absolutely no idea what he's about to get into. In the next several hours, he and his friends will become embroiled with drug dogs, pirates, Russian gangsters, angry strippers, a pimp as big as the Death Star, a very desperate Haitian refugee on the run with her two children, a fanatically secret group of powerful businessmen known only as the Group of Six, much more powerful than the Group of 11, and an 11-foot Burmese albino python named Blossom. And there's still 2 days to go before the wedding. As it turns out, it's not smooth sailing. It's more like a trip on the Titanic. By the end, amid gunfire, high-speed chases, and mayhem of the most unimaginable sort, violent men will fall, heroes will rise, and many lives will change. Seth's, not the least of all. Dave Barry has written many hilarious books before, but he's never written anything like Insane City. Just ask that Mark Twain guy. And now, Insane City, Episode 1, Chapter 1. 2 days before his wedding, Seth was in a cab with his best man Marty, who was advising him on the responsibilities of the groom. "Your job," Marty said, "is to get hammered." "I've seen the movie," said Seth. "It never ends well." "It's a tradition," said Marty. "The groom, about to give up his old lifestyle forever, spends one last night partying with his buddies, laughing with them, crying with them."
"Throwing up on them?" said Seth.
"Not on the best man," advised Marty. "That's the function of the lower-ranking groomsmen." The cab was approaching the American Airlines terminal at Reagan Airport.
"One thing," said Seth. "No stripper."
"Seriously?"
"If a stripper shows up, I'll run. I will run like the wind."
"Strippers are traditional," said Marty.
"Strippers are hookers. Remember the one we got for Kevin?" Marty made a face.
"Okay, I'll admit hygiene was not her. She was disgusting, Marty. She personally controlled 2/3 of the world supply of stank. I'd rather get a lap dance from Charles Barkley."
"You want us to get Charles? Because I hear he's pretty responsive to fan requests."
"No stripper. That's what I want."
They were pulling up to the curb.
"I got this," said Marty, paying the cabbie, which was unlike him. "You go inside."
"I gotta get my suitcase."
"I'll get it. You're the groom, man. Let people cater to you."
Seth frowned. It was also unlike Marty to cater.
Marty was, by nature, a cateree. Feeling a twinge of suspicion, Seth put a hand on Marty's shoulder, leaned in eye to eye.
"Marty," he said, "swear to me on your mother that there will be no stripper."
"Absolutely. I swear on my mother. May she rest in peace."
"Your mother's still alive."
"Unfortunately, yes. Now go find the rest of the groom posse."
The rest of the groom posse consisted of Kevin, he of the stanky stripper, and Big Steve. The four of them, Seth, Marty, Kevin, and Big Steve, had been close friends since they met as roommates at the University of Delaware, where they had distinguished themselves by amassing the largest vertical stack of used pizza delivery boxes in the school's history, and, quite possibly, in the annals of higher education. After graduating, they had pursued different career paths, but they remained close friends, connected by the bond of college, as well as the bond of being unsuccessful at everything they had tried since. Seth spotted the hulking mass that was Big Steve by the boarding pass machine, his finger hovering uncertainly over the touchscreen, his face scrunched into a frown, looking like a man about to enter the code that would launch a nuclear strike against Pyongyang, as opposed to a man confirming his selection of an aisle seat. Big Steve was a man who always wanted to make absolutely sure of everything. Standing behind him in a movie concession line was a nightmare. He could take a full 5 minutes to choose a beverage before moving on to the far more difficult issue of what size beverage, not to mention the popcorn decision, which more than once had made him miss the beginning of a feature film. Pacing around Big Steve like a small jittery asteroid orbiting a planet was Kevin, who as always was on his cell phone, lying to somebody about something. As Seth drew near, he gathered that in this case the person being lied to was Kevin's wife. "Feeling a little sick, to be honest," Kevin was saying, shaking his head to Seth to indicate he was in fact feeling fine. No, I'm still going. It means a lot to Seth. I'll take it easy. Skip the partying." Here Kevin grabbed his crotch to indicate that he did not intend to skip the partying. "I know, baby. I know. I'm so sorry you can't come." "Right. You too. Bye." Kevin pocketed his phone, then, with a swift and fluid motion, reached past Big Steve's still hovering finger and stabbed the boarding pass machine screen.
"Hey," said Big Steve, "what the hell?"
Ignoring him, Kevin turned back to Seth. "You ready? Everything good in wedding land?"
"I guess," said Seth.
"There was an issue with the centerpiece."
"What issue?"
"I'm not sure. A couple of days ago, Tina calls up. She's crying like she found out she has cancer. I mean, sobbing. And I go, 'What's wrong?' And she says something about the centerpiece. And I go, 'Hey, the important thing is we love each other and we're getting married.'"
"You stupid shit," said Kevin.
"I know." She goes, "I can't believe you sometimes," and hangs up. Kevin nodded. "We had these wedding favors, little custom-scented soaps that said 'Love and Happiness Always, Karen and Kevin.' But 2 hours before the wedding, Karen discovers they spelled happiness with a Y."
"Oh, man."
"Yeah. Talk about a wedding totally ruined."
"So what happened?"
"Her mom and her aunt opened up all the soaps, we're talking about 145 soaps, and used razors to change the Y's to I's."
"No."
"Yes. You look at the soaps from our wedding, you'll notice that the I is leaning and has no dot."
"No offense, but I never looked at the soap from your wedding."
"Of course not. Nobody did. Nobody gives a shit about wedding favors. But Karen and her mom and her aunt still talk about it, how they saved the day with their razors." Marty appeared, towing his and Seth's suitcases. "Ready, men?" he said. Big Steve was frowning in his boarding pass.
"Row 26, he said. "That's pretty far back, isn't it?"
"We're all in 26, said Seth.
"Maybe we should move closer to the front," said Big Steve.
"Good idea," said Kevin. "Get to Miami a little sooner."
"Maybe we should go through security and find a bar," said Seth.
"You're the groom," said Marty. They took the escalator to the lower concourse and got into the TSA line. Kevin went first, followed by Big Steve and Marty. After they went through the screening, they all turned to watch Seth. This was the first indication he had that something was up. The second was when the TSA agent, a large African-American woman whose name tag read R. Williams, pointed at his suitcase and said, "Is this your bag?"
"Yes," said Seth.
"I need to search it," she said, picking it off the luggage carousel.
"Okay," said Seth, following Agent Williams and his bag. He heard a snorking sound from the direction of the groom posse. Agent Williams hefted the bag onto a table, then put on a pair of blue latex gloves. She opened the bag, and after a few moments of rooting around, pulled out and held up a pinkish, soft rubber object about the size of a football with a dangling electrical cord.
"What is that?" said Seth.
"I was going to ask you that," said Agent Williams.
That's not mine, said Seth. This is your bag, right?
Yes, but that thing is not mine. But it is in your bag. But it's not mine.
I understand that, sir. But it was in your bag.
But it's not mine.
Another agent came over. A thin, prematurely balding man whose tag said W. Pitowski.
Is there a problem? He said.
Agent Williams showed him the pink thing. This was in his bag, but he says it's not his.
It's not, said Seth.
Agent Pitowski was peering at the object.
That's a male sex aid, he said.
A what?
Said Agent Williams.
Artificial vagina, said Agent Pitowski.
Agent Williams dropped the thing. It bounced off the table and rolled, jiggling across the floor, trailing its cord like a badly deformed pig having a seizure. Some travelers stopped to look at it.
I'm sorry, said Agent Williams, but I ain't touching that.
That is not mine, said Seth.
The onlooker's eyes went from the pink thing to Seth, then back to the thing.
Excuse me, said Marty, stepping forward.
Who are you?
Said Agent Pitowski.
Marty pointed at Seth.
I'm this man's attorney.
No, he's not, said Seth. He's not even an attorney.
Well, not technically, said Marty. Not in the sense of practicing law or passing the bar exam. But I do have $117,000 in tuition debt from a third-tier law school, and by God, that should count for something.
He doesn't need a lawyer, said Agent Pitowski. He needs to pick up his vagina and move along.
It's not my vagina, said Seth.
The onlooker crowd was growing.
Do you have any proof that it is his vagina? Said Marty.
Shut up, Marty, said Seth.
Sir, Agent Pitowski said to Seth, if you don't pick it up and move along right now, I'm going to have to detain you.
He's getting married this weekend, said Marty.
That is not my problem, said Agent Pitowski.
It's somebody's problem, said Agent Williams, looking at the thing on the floor.
Seth, with a glare at Marty, grabbed his suitcase, picked up the vagina, and stalked out of the security area. He went to an overflowing trash can and put the vagina on top of the pile, then turned to face the approaching groom posse, festooned with idiotic grins.
Not funny, he said.
Yes, funny, said Kevin. He held up his phone, and soon to be on YouTube.
I'll kill you, said Seth.
Seriously, I will.
Totally worth it, said Kevin.
A briefcase-carrying, suit-wearing man in his 50s approached the trash can. Looking neither left nor right, he opened his briefcase, put the vagina inside, closed the briefcase, and walked briskly away.
I'm guessing a Secretary of Commerce, said Kevin.
Well, he's got himself a nice little unit there, said Marty.
The Fleshmatic Orgatron, top of the line, with heat and pump action, hardly used.
Wait, said Seth.
You used it?
Hardly.
Jesus, said Seth, watching the suited man's back as he disappeared down the concourse.
Kevin said, The bar is this way.
2. The man was telling Lorette to get up, but she was too weak from vomiting. She could not stand, especially not on the wet and slippery deck of the boat, pitching in the turbulent waters of the Gulf Stream.
Get up! Get up! Shouted the man.
The crew were Dominicans, and Lorette had trouble understanding their crude, heavily accented Creole. The man grabbed Lorette's arm and yanked her to her feet so roughly that for a moment she thought she would drop the baby. The thought flashed through her mind. Maybe it would be best. Maybe we should all die now in the angry water. For the 100th time since she had boarded this wretched boat, she wished she had never listened to her sister in Miami, never trusted these men, never left Port-au-Prince with her babies. Stéphane, her little man, had risen with her and was holding on to her dress.
What's happening, Mama?
He said.
It's all right, she said.
The man was pulling her to the back of the boat. She almost fell, struggling to hold onto the baby and keep Stéphane close.
What are you doing? She said to the man.
You are getting off. Lorette looked around, seeing only water in every direction.
No, she said, her voice rising. We go nowhere.
We are close to Miami.
Where is it? Lorette waved at the horizon. Where is Miami?
The man gestured vaguely.
Just over there.
But we can't go closer.
No, shouted Lorette. You said you would take me to my sister, to the meeting place. You promised this.
I'm sorry, said the man. This is not possible.
How will I find my sister?
How?
The man didn't answer.
They had reached the back of the boat. The other men were pulling a rope attached to the tiny beat-up rowboat they had been towing since they left Haiti. Several inches of water sloshed around the bottom of the boat.
No, said Lorette.
She tried to yank her arm free. The man tightened his grip. Lorette cried out in pain.
The current will take you to Miami, the man said. You'll be there in an hour.
Please, no, said Lorette. We will go back with you to Haiti.
No, said the man, dragging her toward the little boat. You must get off here.
No, screamed Lorette. No, please.
The man ignored her. He and the others grabbed Lorette and Stéphane and lifted them roughly over the side into the little boat. It was pitching violently. Lorette fell awkwardly, bumping the baby's head against the side. The baby was screaming now. Stéphane was crying. Lorette pulled them both to her. She looked up at the men.
Please, she said. They are babies. Please.
The men looked away. The motor rumbled, and the big boat churned away. In a few minutes, it was a dark, tiny shape in the distance. Then it was gone. The little ship pitched up and down on the rough water.
Mama, said Stéphane, what's going to happen to us?
Lorette meant to lie to her son, tell him they would be all right. But all it came out, before she could choke it off, was a wail. 3. The airport bar was full of people sitting alone and staring at screens. Seth had a grande margarita. Kevin and Marty each had two. Big Steve had none, having been unable to decide between the grande and the supremo. The supremo featured Patron tequila, but also cost $2 more, and Big Steve wasn't sure it would be worth it. In an effort to decide, he had asked the bartender a series of increasingly specific ingredient-related questions. But this line of inquiry came to an abrupt halt when the bartender, who was busy, asked Big Steve if he planned to drink the margarita or use it as an enema. The flight, miraculously, was on time. Kevin, taking charge, maneuvered the groom posses so they got into the boarding line directly behind two attractive women, one blonde and one brunette. "You ladies headed for Miami?" he said. The women looked at each other, then at Kevin.
"No," said the brunette. "We just like being in line."
"Good one," said Kevin, sticking out his hand. "I'm Kevin." Neither woman stuck out her hand.
"Kevin's married," said Seth.
"She's a lucky woman," said the blonde.
"Who's not going to Miami, as it happens," said Kevin.
"No, it's just us four guys looking for a good time. How about you ladies?"
"No," said the brunette.
"No what?" said Kevin.
"Just generally no," said the brunette.
"My name is Marty," said Marty. "By the way, I'm not married."
"We're lesbians," said the blonde.
"Fine with me," said Marty.
"Are you really?" said Kevin.
"No," said the blonde.
"But keep this up and we will be."
"I apologize for my friends," said Seth.
"I bet you do," said the brunette.
They boarded the plane, found their seats. Seth, his groom, got the window. He was next to Kevin, who was still lobbing unsuccessful pickup lines forward, like grenades, across three rows of increasingly annoyed passengers, at the blonde and the brunette seated in row 22. They did not respond, but Kevin persisted until a flight attendant shushed him for the safety briefing.
"Kevin," said Seth, "let me ask you something."
"What?"
said Kevin.
"What about Karen?"
"Karen?"
"Your wife."
"Who you're married to?"
"Karen."
"What about her?"
"Do you love her?"
"Of course I love her. She's my wife."
"So how can you do this?"
"Do what?"
"Try to screw every woman you meet."
"Not every woman."
92%.
But, I mean, how would Karen feel?
Karen doesn't know.
What if she found out?
I'd say it was a terrible mistake, and I was very sorry, and I would never do it again.
And would you mean that?
Absolutely not.
So being married means nothing to you?
No.
It means I have a person I love very much and want to raise a family with.
And cheat on.
Wait, so you think it'll be different with you and Tina?
Yes.
So you're saying, if one of those two very hot women sitting up there, let's say the blonde, if that woman said she wanted to get naked with you, no strings attached, just crazy animal sex that Tina would never find out about, you'd turn her down? You'd say, no thanks, hot blonde with breasts like honeydews. Keep your nakedness to yourself, because I'm in a committed relationship.
Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying, yes.
You're full of shit.
No, I'm not, said Seth. And he genuinely believed he wasn't. Although he knew in his heart that if the question had been about the brunette, he might have been. They drank more on the flight, even Big Steve, who was aided by the fact that there were only two brands of beer available, which meant he was able to make a selection in under 5 minutes. After two vodka and cranberries, Kevin made one last valiant effort to storm the blonde brunette beachhead, walking up and handing them a note he'd written on an air sickness bag. He stood waiting as they read it. The blonde looked up.
Seriously?
She said loud enough that several rows worth of passengers tuned in to the conversation.
From the heart,
said Kevin. No, I mean seriously. You don't know the difference between Y-O-U-R and Y-O-U-apostrophe-R-E?
It's a rough draft, said Kevin.
Also, said the brunette, tossing the bag back to Kevin, there's no E in horny. Kevin returned to his seat next to Seth.
Bitches, he said.
I know, said Seth. If women don't want crude propositions written by illiterates on barf bags, what do they want? In 2 hours, they were over the vast green muckscape of the Everglades, banking toward the skinny strip of hyperdevelopment where several million South Floridians live close together in nothing remotely approaching harmony. They landed, taxied, parked at the gate. Seth and his groom posse joined the line of exiting passengers and shuffled unsteadily out of the plane. In the jetway, they were enveloped by the sweetish aroma of tropical decay that welcomes visitors to Miami the way Mickey Mouse welcomes them in Orlando.
"What's that smell?" said Marty.
"Miami," said Seth.
"What, the whole city has mildew?"
"Basically." Seth's phone rang the instant he turned it on. He looked at the screen. Tina. He saw she'd also left 6 text messages. This was not good. There had been a time when many of Tina's messages were playful, flirtatious, romantic, even sexual. But in the past few months, the vast majority concerned the ongoing and infinitely complex crisis that was the seating chart for the reception.
"Hello?" he said.
"Are you in Miami?"
said Tina.
"Yes, we just come to baggage claim right now."
"You're still in the airport?" Tina had flown in on an earlier flight with her bridal party. She was supposed to be at the hotel by now.
"I got delayed," she said, "by this stupid dog."
"A dog?"
"Seth, it alerted on my dress."
"It what?"
"They're saying I have to..."
"Wait a minute.
Don't touch that. You're going to ruin it."
"Tina, what?"
"Just get down here, okay?"
"Okay. But what's happening? Which baggage claim? Hello?" Tina was gone.
"What was that about?" said Marty.
"I don't know. Tina said a dog did something to her dress."
"Like peed on it?"
"I don't know. I just have to go to baggage claim." He heard her from 25 yards away. Tina had a strong, confident voice. It was the reason Seth had met her in the first place, on the grounds of the Washington Monument. He'd heard this woman's voice talking through a bullhorn, and he wondered if the owner of the voice was hot. And it turned out she was.
She was leading a protest either for or against something. Seth could not remember which. He had stuck around and managed to meet her afterward. She had believed then, and still did believe, that he was there for the protest. He had never told her that he was merely passing through on his way home from playing Ultimate Frisbee. Tina was a fast-rising, plugged-in lawyer in a D.C. firm that specialized in social causes and getting on television. She cared passionately about disadvantaged people, all of them. She was intelligent and beautiful and had a killer body. Men wanted and pursued her. It was a source of widespread bafflement that Seth had managed to win her hand. Seth himself did not understand it. He knew he was fairly good-looking. He had been told that by enough women. But Tina had plenty other attractive men after her, and many of them possessed desirable qualities that he did not. Employability, for example. Upon graduating from college, Seth had discovered that he was fundamentally unequipped to do anything that anybody was willing to pay serious money for. His degree was in marketing, and he'd earned a solid B average. But the harsh truth was, he had never actually marketed anything, and neither had any of the professors who had taught him what he knew about marketing. After college, he'd gone to Washington, telling himself that there were many good reasons for him to look for work there aside from the obvious and pathetic truth, which was that he could live with his parents. This led to 2 years of unemployment and humiliating underemployment, including a stint handing out flyers at a mall for a 20% discount at a teeth whitening booth. It was during this stint he found himself handing a flyer to Jennifer Claremont, whom he had dated for 2 years in high school. She went on to graduate summa cum laude from the University of Michigan and was midway through Stanford Medical School. By the time Seth realized who she was, she had the flyer in hand. He quickly assured her that her teeth did not need whitening and, in fact, looked great. This was followed by a hideously awkward pause-filled conversation, during which they avoided any discussion of what Seth was doing and agreed at least 4 times that it was really great to see each other. When they finally managed to break apart, they walked briskly in opposite directions, neither looking back. Seth proceeded directly to a trash can, into which he dumped all of his flyers. He then drove straight home from the mall, went to his room, and played Grand Theft Auto 3, where lunatics prosper, for 7 straight hours. He finally found permanent work, of sorts, at a large Beltway public relations firm, where he was assigned to the social media mobilization team, which sounded a lot more impressive than what the team members called themselves, namely, tweet whores. Seth's job was to try to generate buzz for clients by posting Facebook updates and sending out enthusiastic tweets under various Twitter screen names. He had tweeted enthusiastically about a wide range of products, including forklifts, energy bars, and douche. He was paid a salary in the low 30s, augmented by incentive bonuses based on total followers, retweets, etc. In a typical week, Seth's bonus was around $20, which was why, when he met Tina, he was still living with his parents. Tina, who came from money, buckets of it, had her own place in Georgetown. She was dating an attorney who looked like Jude Law. He had argued before the Supreme Court, and had been named one of Washington's most eligible bachelors by 2 different glossy magazines. And yet, when Seth asked Tina that day near the monument, she glowing radiantly from bullhorning on behalf of or against something, he sweating from Ultimate Frisbee, if she'd like to meet for coffee sometime, she said yes, as long as it wasn't a Starbucks. Seth didn't know then. He still didn't really know. Why it couldn't be a Starbucks. This, he would learn, was one of the many principled stands Tina took as a consumer. It seemed to Seth that at least half of the products in any given supermarket offended her. They met at a coffee shop specializing in coffee that did not take advantage of the disadvantaged.
She asked him what he did, and he told her he was in marketing. By a skillfully lawyer probing, she quickly determined what he actually did, then whipped out her iPhone and started looking up his tweets.
"Wow," she said, reading the screen.
"So," said Seth, "what kind of law do you..."
"Woman fresh," she read, "because you never know when somebody unexpected will drop in."
She looked up at Seth and said, "Drop in?"
"Hey," said Seth, "that got retweeted."
She stared at him for several long seconds, during which he was sure she was about to walk out of his life forever. Instead, she started laughing. She had a deep, hearty laugh, very unladylike. She insisted on reading all of his woman-fresh tweets. Each one struck her as more hilarious than the one before, to the point where it took her nearly 30 seconds to gasp out, "When you need to feel confident down there."
"Confident?" she said.
"Down there?"
"What?"
said Seth. "You don't call it that?" She couldn't answer. She was weeping, fighting for breath, waving her arm in a "Stop it, you're killing me" motion. He decided right then that he was in love with her. They went out again, then again and again. He sent her flowers. She formally broke up with Jude Lawyer. He started attempting to become informed about current events other than sports. She followed him on Twitter. On their fifth date, she invited him to spend the night. At a critical physical moment, he made a joke about dropping in, which gave her such a case of giggles that he thought he'd blown his opportunity. But it turned out he had not. 2 months later, moving in with her, having concluded the embarrassment of being provided for by his girlfriend was more bearable than the embarrassment of living with his mom and dad, she got to know his friends and found them to be amusing, but not of long-term interest. He got to know her friends and found they ranged from serious to deadly serious, with tendency toward assholery. For their part, they found Seth to be unimpressive, as did Tina's parents, who viewed Seth as unworthy to house-sit their pets, let alone marry their daughter. Seth basically agreed with their assessment of him. One night at a restaurant, Tina got into a lengthy, passionate argument with her lawyer friends about the Commerce Clause. Seth went to the men's room and hastily, in a stall, took out his iPhone and read the Wikipedia article about the Commerce Clause, but he still didn't see why it was a big deal. He spent the evening sitting silent among the brains, feeling like an entirely different organ, or an unusually large hemorrhoid. When I got home that night, he asked Tina why she wanted to be with him.
"Because I love you," she said.
"But why?"
"You make me laugh."
"So does Danny DeVito."
"Yes, but he's taken."
He tried many times, but never really got a better answer than that. For whatever reason, Tina was attracted to him. And, for whatever other reason, she was not interested in explaining specifically why. Eventually, he gave up trying to figure it out. His feeling was, if this beautiful, smart woman wanted to be with him, why ask why? And so, after a year of cohabitation, he had asked her to marry him. And to the poorly concealed dismay of her friends and parents, she had said yes. In their first few happy, innocent hours as an engaged couple, they talked of a small, informal wedding, just immediate family and close friends. When Seth told Kevin about this, Kevin snorted beer out his nose.
"What?" said Seth.
"Really?" said Kevin. "Small and informal?"
"Yes," said Seth. "That's what we want."
"That's what you want."
"Tina wants it, too."
"Tina says she wants it. She might even believe she wants it, but that's not what you're going to have." Not once her mom starts reminding her about all the second cousins whose children's wedding her mom got invited to. Not once Tina starts reading the bride magazines, and definitely not once she meets with the wedding planner. We're not having a wedding planner.
"If you don't have a wedding planner," Kevin said, "I will get on my knees and personally blow you at a major intersection during rush hour. Because, trust me,
you will have a wedding planner. You're already caught in the force field of the wedding industry, Death Star, my friend. It has you in a tractor beam, and it's sucking you in. There's no escape. You will also have a floral installation artist.
You mean a florist?
No, I mean a floral installation artist.
What the hell is that?
Kevin snorted again. Seth now knew what a floral installation artist was. It was a florist, only way more expensive. He and Tina had one whose name, as the payee on the checks, was Warren Cramsden, but who went professionally by Raoul. No last name, just Raoul. They also had a wedding planner, whose legal name was now Blaze Gear, it having been legally changed from Gretchen Wentworth. Blaze had two assistants, Tracy and Tracy. Under the relentless guidance of these professionals, Seth and Tina's small and formal wedding for close friends and family underwent wedding bloat, mutating into a large formal affair that would be attended by many people neither of them knew. Seth objected at first, but he backed down when he realized that Kevin had been right. Tina wanted a big wedding.
"Just go along," advised Kevin. "Here's how you look at it. Tina has a disease. Bride's disease. They all get it. There's no cure except having a wedding. Until she has one, she's going to be basically insane. She's going to demand that you give a shit about silver patents. Just hang in there until the wedding, and then it'll all go away and she'll be basically normal again, except for sometimes making people watch the video." Seth took Kevin's advice. He went along. Over the past year, he'd spent countless hours looking with a frown of attempted interest at place settings and cakes and calligraphy samples. They finally settled on Bickham Copperplate with swash capitals. He did his best to stay connected with what he thought of as real Tina, who was trapped inside Bride Tina. He saw glimpses of her and sometimes even got real Tina to laugh at Bride Tina. But she hadn't laughed much in recent months, and now that the wedding was at hand, she hardly laughed at all. She was definitely not laughing now. Seth couldn't yet see her as he trotted toward the baggage carousel. A crowd of onlookers was blocking his view, but he definitely could hear her. She was using her bullhorn voice. "Are you familiar with the Fourth Amendment?" she was asking somebody, evidently rhetorically. "Can you morons even count to four?" Seth, trailing his carry-on suitcase and leaving the groom posse behind, started running toward his bride. 4. Lorette now knew that she and her children were going to die. The men had lied to her. The current was not taking the little boat to Miami. She saw nothing in any direction but the dark, tossing Atlantic. The little boat was taking on water. It was over her ankles now. From time to time she tried to splash it out with her hands, but it was difficult to do this while holding the baby and with Stephane clinging to her. The baby had finally stopped crying, too exhausted now even to whimper. Stephane was trying to be brave, but his eyes shone with fear. Lorette hoped he could not see her own terror. She dared not meet his eyes when he asked her over and over where it would end. When they would reach the land. Soon, she told him, over and over. Soon. She prayed that, when death came to them, it would be swift. 5. Seth pushed his way through the crowd of onlookers and found a standoff at the baggage carousel. On one side stood Tina, in jeans and a scoop-necked white T-shirt, looking angry, but as always spectacular. On the other side were two uniformed U.S. Customs officers, one of whom held a leash attached to a German shepherd. On the floor between the two sides was Tina's $950 Tumi suitcase, which was open, revealing Tina's wedding dress. This apparently was of great interest to the dog, whose sleek black snout had zeroed in on the suitcase at a range of about 2 inches.
Watching from several feet away was Tina's younger sister and maid of honor, Megan, who would be considered beautiful if she weren't always being held to the standard of Tina, a comparison that lowered Megan's status to merely very pretty.
"Hey, babe," said Seth, reaching Tina's side. "What's going on?"
Tina looked at him for a second, registering his presence, then turned her attention back to the dog.
"If that animal drools on my dress, I will sue for damages," Tina said. "That is my wedding dress, and I'm getting married Saturday. I am getting married in that dress. Do you understand?"
"We understand that, ma'am," said the customs agent, holding the leash, a stocky, balding, worried-looking man named Vincent Peppers. "You made that very clear several times."
"Six times," said the other customs agent, a dark-haired, muscular man named Roberto Alvarez.
"But like I told you, ma'am," continued Agent Peppers, "when we get an indication from the dog, we have to investigate it. And Sienna alerted on your luggage."
"Sienna?" said Tina.
"Sienna is the dog," said Peppers. "It's a color, like the crayon. Burnt sea."
"I know it's a color," snapped Tina.
"Well, not everybody does," said Peppers. "So what we're going to do is we're going to take out the dress and..."
"You're not going to touch the dress," said Tina. "I am getting married in that dress."
"Seven," said Agent Alvarez.
"It's hemp," said Seth.
"What?" said Peppers.
"The dress," said Seth. "It's made from hemp."
Tina wanted a green wedding and had insisted on using, wherever possible, sustainable fibers. The floral installations featured organic, locally grown flowers, herbs, and grasses. The wedding rings were made of recycled gold. The band and the DJ had pledged to offset their electricity use with renewable energy certificates. And to compensate for all of the air travel, a company in Guatemala was theoretically planting a shitload of trees.
"Who are you?" said Alvarez.
"Her fiancé," said Seth.
Alvarez emitted a snort. Seth gave him a look, got one back.
"Doesn't look like hemp," said Agent Peppers. "It's white."
"It's ivory," said Tina. "That's a color, like sienna."
"You don't need to patronize me, ma'am," said Agent Peppers.
"Is there a problem here?"
said Marty, arriving on the scene.
"Go away, Marty," said Seth.
"Who are you?" said Alvarez.
"I'm this woman's attorney," said Marty.
"No, he's not," said Seth and Tina simultaneously.
"Overruled," said Marty. "Now, officer, we can either do this the easy way, or we can do it the...
Hey!" Propelled by a shove from Seth, Marty stumbled back to Kevin and Big Steve. Seth turned back to Peppers. "Here's the thing," he said. "Hemp and marijuana are related, right? So maybe your dog smells the hemp, and he thinks it's marijuana, so he..."
"She," said Peppers. "Sienna's a female."
"A bitch," said Alvarez, looking at Tina. "An overly aggressive animal with a small brain," said Tina, looking back, "and no ability to think for itself."
"Oh, Sienna's pretty smart," said Peppers.
"I'm not talking about the dog," said Tina.
"My point," said Seth hastily, "is that Sienna has probably just picked up on the similarity between the hemp fibers and the marijuana."
"Maybe so," said Agent Peppers. "But we still have to examine the suitcase."
"You will not touch that suitcase," said Tina.
"I'm afraid we have to, ma'am," said Peppers.
"No, you don't," said Tina, stepping in front of the suitcase.
"Ma'am," said Peppers, "if you don't let us examine your suitcase, I'm going to have to bring the police into this."
"Go right ahead," said Tina.
Seth said, "Tina, maybe that's not a great idea." She spun around, eyes blazing, and snapped,
"Don't you dare take their side."
"I'm not taking their side. I'm just saying if he calls the police..."
"Let him," said Tina.
She added quietly, "I already called my father."
"Oh," said Seth.
Tina's father was the only person Seth knew who owned two personal helicopters. As if on cue, Pepper's phone rang. He removed it from his belt holster and said, "Hello?
Yes, it is.
That's right. And who...
Oh,
Oh, yes, sir. He listened for about a minute and said, "Yes, sir," a few more times, then reholstered the phone. His face was now the color of Hawaiian punch. "Okay," he said to Tina, "you can go."
"What?" said Alvarez. "Who was that?"
"I'll tell you later."
"Wait a minute," said Alvarez. "She can't just go."
Tina smiled sweetly at Alvarez. "Yes, she can," said Peppers. "Come on, Sienna." He led the dog away. Alvarez stayed a few more seconds looking at the suitcase. Then he looked at Seth and said, "I bet you'll look beautiful in that dress."
"Something for you to fantasize about," said Seth.
Alvarez started to say something, then turned and walked away.
"Asshole," said Tina, crouching to zip up the suitcase.
Seth said, "I can't believe the dog reacted to the dress." Tina looked up.
"It wasn't the dress," she said. "It wasn't.
It was Megan's pot. It was under the dress."
"Jesus, Tina," said Seth, looking at Megan, who smiled sheepishly. "What the hell?"
"She had it in her purse, but she got all paranoid. The TSA would find it, so she asked me to put it in my suitcase."
"And you did?"
"She's my sister, Seth. And I didn't think there'd be drug dogs here."
"It's Miami, Tina. They got drug dogs in the preschools."
Tina stood. "Well, it doesn't matter now, does it?"
"I guess not," said Seth, "thanks to your father."
She looked at him for a second, then said, "It's a stupid law, okay?"
"Okay," said Seth. In the distance, he could see Alvarez looking back at him.
The groom posse had drifted up. Kevin, Marty, and Big Steve exchanged hugs with Tina and Megan.
"So," said Tina, "you boys have big plans for Seth tonight?"
"Big plans," said Marty.
"Huge plans," said Kevin.
"No stripper," said Seth.
"What?"
said Kevin.
"No stripper," repeated Seth.
"Then what's the point of even getting married?" said Kevin.
"If we're not getting a stripper," said Big Steve, "I want my $40 back."
"Wow," said Megan. $40 whole?
"A piece," said Marty.
"Oh, $40 apiece, said Megan. "So this will be like the Mercedes-Benz of strippers?"
"Marty," said Seth, "you swore on your mother there would be no stripper."
"Yeah, but I hate my mother," said Marty.
"He has you there," said Kevin.
"Okay," said Tina. "Sounds like you boys have important matters to discuss. We got a car waiting outside and lots to do at the hotel. And then we've got the dinner with my parents. I'll see you later, okay?"
"Tina," said Seth, "I'm not going to let them... I mean, it's not gonna be..."
She stopped him with a hand on his arm.
"Just have fun with your friends and don't get any diseases," she said. "And be ready for the rehearsal dinner tomorrow night, okay?"
"Okay," said Seth. She kissed him and left with her sister.
"She's really not threatened, is she?" said Kevin.
"If you look like that," said Marty, "would you be threatened?" "If I look like that," said Kevin, "I'd spend all day standing naked in front of a mirror."
"Hey," said Seth.
"Okay, but I would."
"Let's get the bags, grab a taxi to the hotel. Start the party," said Marty.
"Maybe there's a shuttle to the hotel," said Big Steve.
"Good point," said Kevin.
"Why don't you look into that, weigh the pros and cons? Text us your findings in the next day or so. We'll be at the hotel."
"I do not want a stripper," said Seth.
"Absolutely not," said Marty.
They collected their bags and hailed a taxi van driven by a man in a bulging Rastafarian hat who radiated pot fumes and whose radio was playing a song that apparently consisted of a single extremely low note played over and over at the volume of artillery fire.
"We're going to the Ritz-Carlton on Key Biscayne," shouted Seth.
The driver turned and looked at Seth, frowning.
"Do you know where that is?" shouted Seth.
"What is?" shouted the driver.
"The Ritz-Carlton Hotel," shouted Seth.
"Coconut Grove?" shouted the driver.
"No, the Ritz-Carlton on Key Biscayne," shouted Seth.
"Ritz-Carlton Hotel?" shouted the driver.
"Yes, on Key Biscayne," shouted Seth. "Do you think you could turn the music down?"
The driver, not turning the music down, put the cab in gear and began driving.
"Friendly chap," said Kevin.
"What?" said Seth.
"Never mind," said Kevin.
Since conversation was impossible, they all whipped out phones, put their heads down, and commenced thumbing. After 20 minutes, the taxi pulled to a stop. A doorman opened the van door and said, "Welcome to the Ritz-Carlton." They got out, unloaded their bags. Marty paid the driver, who pulled out the hotel driveway, his taxi still throbbing. Seth looked around.
"Wait a minute," he said.
"Where are we?"
"The Ritz-Carlton," said Kevin, pointing to a sign that said Ritz-Carlton.
"It looks wrong," said Seth. He turned to the doorman and said, "Is this Key Biscayne?"
"No," said the doorman, "Coconut Grove."
"Shit," said Seth.
"We should have taken the shuttle," said Big Steve.
"Can you get us a cab?"
Seth asked the doorman.
"Okay," said the doorman.
He stuck 2 fingers into his mouth and emitted a shrill whistle. From around the corner came the sound of booming bass. The same taxi rolled into the driveway. Rasta dude at the wheel.
"I don't believe this," said Kevin. "Is this guy the entire Miami taxi fleet?"
"Can we get another taxi?" Seth asked the doorman.
The doorman whistled again, then again. No taxi appeared.
"Not many taxis around right now," he said.
Reluctantly, they got back into the taxi. The driver gave no indication that he recognized them.
"We want you to take us to Key Biscayne," shouted Kevin.
"Okay? Key Biscayne."
Without answering, the driver put the taxi in gear. He drove to Bayshore Drive and turned right.
"No," said Seth, waving his arms. "I think it's the other way."
He pointed toward the back of the cab. "I think we need to go that way to Key Biscayne."
"I know Key Biscayne," said the driver. "You keep telling me Key Biscayne, Key Biscayne, Key Biscayne. I know this."
Seth fell back against the seat.
"Fine," he said. "I'll handle this," said Marty. "You had a groom. Just relax, okay?"
"Okay," said Seth.
"Driver," said Marty.
"I know," said the driver. "Key Biscayne."
Seth was developing a headache, closed his eyes, and tried to relax. After about 15 minutes, he felt the taxi slow. He opened his eyes. They were inching along in heavy traffic next to a row of hotels.
"This is Ocean Drive," he said.
"I know," said Marty.
"Nice, huh?"
"Marty, Ocean Drive is on Miami Beach."
"Is that on the way to Key Biscayne?" said Marty.
"No," said Seth. He shouted to the driver, "We want to go to Key Biscayne."
"I know.
Key Biscayne.
I know this," replied the driver, taking both hands off the wheel so he could make a gesture to indicate how irritated he was by this incessant jabber about the destination being Key Biscayne.
Seth turned to his posse and said, "This guy doesn't know how to get to Key Biscayne."
"But he's a taxi driver," said Kevin.
"He's a Miami taxi driver," said Seth.
He tapped the driver's shoulder and shouted, "Stop! Here! Let us get out!"
"We're getting out here," said Big Steve, "with our suitcases."
"If we stay in this taxi," said Seth, "we'll wind up in Belize."
They got out and unloaded the luggage. They refused to pay the driver, who, after shouting something incomprehensible, slammed his door and thumped slowly away in the thick traffic.
"Okay," said Seth, "we need to find another taxi."
"You think there's more than one?" said Kevin.
They looked down Ocean Drive, surveying the bumper-to-bumper line of tourist-driven rental cars crawling past sidewalk cafe tables filled with tourists drinking fruit-festooned rum drinks and watching the passing pedestrian parade of still more tourists. There were no taxis in sight. They started walking, luggage in tow, weaving their way through the maze of sidewalk tables. After a block and a half, they came to the Clevelander, a legendary South Beach bar bearing no resemblance to anything that has ever existed in Cleveland. On a small stage, next to the packed bar, a woman wearing a basically invisible bikini
was writhing to inhumanly loud pounding music. Nearby, beneath a sign that said DJ Booga Wooga, was a man wearing black lace-up boots and a purple thong held up by orange suspenders. He was shouting into a microphone, "Last call for the Miss Hot Amateur Bod Contest. Ladies, come on up. First prize is $100. Come on, ladies. Let's see what you got." Standing near the DJ were a dozen young women wearing garments that, if all of them were combined, might have provided enough fabric to make a sock.
"We should stop here," said Kevin.
"No, we shouldn't," said Seth. "We need to get to the Ritz."
"We can't get to the Ritz," said Kevin. "Admit it. We tried and we failed."
"Plus," said Marty, "they don't have Miss Hot Amateur Bod at the Ritz, not to mention DJ Booga Wooga." Seth looked back out at Ocean Drive. Still no taxis.
"Maybe there's a bus to Key Biscayne," said Big Steve.
"Shut up, Steve," said Kevin.
"Come on, Seth," said Marty. "One drink."
"Okay," said Seth, dragging his suitcase toward the bar. "One drink."
3 hours later, they were on their fifth pitcher of margaritas. The pitchers were $50 apiece, plus a generous tip for Vicky, the bartender, with whom Kevin had fallen deeply in love. Kevin was also in love with Cindy Friend Gonzalez, an outgoing young woman who had finished fourth in the Miss Hot Amateur Bod competition and who was wearing a dress made from roughly 1 square inch of some extremely stretchy material. At Kevin's invitation, Cindy had joined the groom posse at the bar, and she had in turn been joined by a friend of hers, a large, bald man named Duane. The posse was not thrilled about Duane, but nobody told him to leave because, in addition to being large, he had an 11-foot Burmese albino python named Blossom draped over his shoulders. Duane made his living collecting tips from tourists who wanted to have their pictures taken with Blossom. He'd been doing this for 8 years and considered himself a professional. He also considered himself an ambassador for Miami, and upon learning that Seth was about to get married, he had appointed himself as tour guide.
"This is my fucking town," he said. "Si habla Españolo? You need weed? Oxy?"
"I think we're good," said Seth. Duane brandished Blossom.
"You want to hold her?"
"No charge for the groom, man."
"Maybe later," said Seth, leaning back to avoid Blossom's flicking tongue.
"Just say the word," said Duane, pouring Seth and himself another glass from the pitcher, finishing it. Kevin waved to Vicky for another.
"And we'll leave Seth and his posse with Duane and Blossom and Cindy at the Clevelander Bar, for our time is up for today. Please join me again when we continue with Insane City by Dave Barry. This has been Jim Beatty for GARS, the Georgia Radio Reading Service."
That's all the time we have. Thank you for joining us for the Noon Book Hour. We hope you'll join us again tomorrow for our next installment from the Recording Library of West Texas.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the coronavirus update, followed by USA Today at 2. Sunday afternoons, we take you around the Lone Star State for 3 hours, starting at 2 p.m. with Texas Monthly Archives. At 3, it's the current issue of Texas Monthly Magazine. At 4, Travelin' Texas. And at 4:30, Texas Gardener. Sunday afternoons, beginning at 2, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio. Read by listening.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 77 and clear. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the low 70s. Then, tomorrow, a few showers with a high in the low 80s. Tomorrow night, a few showers with a low in the mid-60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 1 p.m.
Welcome to your coronavirus update for Friday, September 4th, 2020. I'm Michael from the Recording Library of West Texas, and here are some of the stories that we'll be reading today. Dr. Sanjay Gupta says he's discouraged and frustrated by Americans' reaction to coronavirus. Widespread COVID-19